environment, buries it deep down under pressure for a while, kind of cooks it for a couple million years, and reduces it to just relatively simple carbon in the part of oil, it's carbohydrates, but in the part of coal deposits, it's pretty much pure carbon. So just think what might have happened 300 million years ago and the strange way that life seems to work. And if you have any suggestions, please feel free.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
I don't know, it seems very obvious. Was it the demise of the of all those reptiles and everything when the meteor hit?
It was the wrong era. That was only 60 million years ago. This went on from about 360 million years ago to 300 million years ago in what's called the Carboniferous geological era.
All right, I was challenged just turning the clocks back, so maybe someone else will figure it out.
Okay, well, let me tell you a little story about plants in general that kind of will hopefully act as a bit of a hint. One of the most, in some ways, disastrous thing that happened to this planet was the creation of plants. Up until then, very simple, they called anaerobic. They don't operate on oxygen. Matter of fact, oxygen is toxic to them in any kind of reasonable concentration. Anaerobic bacteria basically covered the earth, and it was quite happy if an anaerobic bacteria can be happy. And all of a sudden evolved these strange things that could use sunlight to create more high energy chemical bonds. And that was the early algae and such. And as a side effect of photosynthesis, it poured tons and tons of incredibly reactive oxygen into the environment. It slaughtered trillions and trillions of anaerobic bacteria before they evolved methods of hiding away in little nooks and crannies to get away from that oxygen. So they wreaked the plant world has wreaked havoc repeatedly on the environment. So that's a story of the early lifetime of plants, but it's a bit of a hint of why 360 million years ago there were a lot of trees and a lot of fossil fuel from trees, and why 300 million years ago, not so many.
JD2NVB.
Yes, Bob.
Yes, I'm just wondering, I don't know, can anaerobic bacteria decay and fertilize, make soil fertile? I don't know if they can or not, but that's my guess. Back to you.
Hey, well, but you got to realize that the rise of the plant age predates the Carboniferous era. Yeah, the bacteria in general can decompose, and the nitrogen fertilizer, the nitrogen material inside bacteria can produce a degree of nutrients for a growing plant or tree or what have you.
So does that mean I'm onto something or not? Back to you, Roy.
Oh, I kind of gave you a hint that wasn't in time, but in consequences of a billion years ago, and I think you're trying to connect it to what happened 300 million years ago.
Okay, so I'll let it go. Let someone else pick it up. Back to you, Roy.
Hey, Bob. Well, the question is still open to the anyone who wants to hazard a guess. What do you think might have changed in the world either within those 60 million years, before those 60 million years, after those 60 million years. There was something strange about those 60 million years. So, and I kind of told you a little story of how plant life evolved and revolutionized the world. So you're going to kind of hear an echo of the same type of phenomena in a slightly different version. So that's your hint for tonight. So unfortunately, I didn't get your call sign.
I believe your comment, your story about plant life is a red herring. I'll just say the statement, tectonic plate, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay, so I guess what you're kind of throwing away my hint as completely specious, and you're saying that the reason why there's a large amount of coal available from 360 to 300 million years ago was simply that's how plate tectonics kind of trapped it at that time and didn't trap it other times.
That's pretty much it. Saying that your story is a red herring, I suppose, is not entirely true. I think you intentionally did say that story to sort of throw people off into the wrong direction. KDJ.
I mean, honestly, you know, when I tell people I'm giving them a hint, it's a hint. It's not a fake hint. I mean, I might pose questions that seem a little tricky and seem non-intuitive, because if I gave you a question that's kind of very intuitive and you can intuit it, then it wouldn't be that much fun. It would take about 3 seconds and we'd be done. Now, once again, I can't tell you that this was certified by some laboratory as the absolute positive only method. I'm just giving it to you as one of the most popularly believed theories of the phenomena of why so much of the coal was created in such a narrow timeline for the Earth. So there might be proponents for your theory of tectonics trapping it. I would, though, have some kind of a problem in that, you know, plate tectonics is a never-ending constant thing. So I don't know how you just kind of trap it within a 60-million-year period unless you're presupposing that there's a lot of coal that's in some location that we can't get at because it went deeper into the crust of the Earth. One more time, let me just ask around if anyone else has any ideas what could have changed in our lovely world to have created this abundance of coal and then this incredible lack of abundance of coal.
Roy, is it possible that at that period of time, all the continents were all grouped together, called Pangaea? You had a certain level of water at that time, so you had a lot of swampy territory. The trees were growing in the swampy territory, dying and laying in that swamp. And mushrooms had not yet been invented, and microorganisms had not yet been invented that eat up the trees. So nothing was decaying the trees at that time, and therefore they sat there and became solidified. Is that a possibility? Over to you, Roy. K2RIW.
Give that man a cigar. I don't know if Pangaea and the swamps were that important in the mechanism, but before the Carboniferous era, there were a lot of plants, but they weren't actually trees. And then about 360 million years ago, plants evolved to produce and use some of the earliest, we would call them plastics, that this world has seen. They started to manufacture a lot of cellulose and a material called lignin. Lignin is a cross-linked phenol. It makes up about 20 to 35% of the dry mass of a piece of wood these days. Now, these polymers offered the plants a much greater strength, and they allowed them to grow much larger and much taller than ever before. and that evolutionary trick spread right across the Earth because it favored their survival so incredibly. It was a revolutionary advance for the plant kingdom. It improved survivability, and it just spread all over the place. But what happens when the party's over and it's time to clean up the place, if you will? Unfortunately, since, as Dick mentioned, the bacteria and the fungi that tend to digest all dead stuff and recycle it hadn't gotten any prior notice from the new trees. They had no way to deal with the new stuff that the trees were putting together. And so the forest floor was littered by a growing pile of dead trees that didn't know how to leave the party gracefully. It took fungi and bacteria over 60 million years to evolve different effective means to digest these lignins and cellulose effectively. They both came up with completely different methods, but in the end, they both worked. So these piles of trees over the first 60 million years were swallowed into the earth, and over time, they decomposed into coal that we know and love. Some of us do. But that was then. Since then, the trees die. They fall in the forest. If a lumberjack doesn't cart them away, some fungus and some bacteria return the tree back to the great cycle of life. So the opportunity for dead plants to survive underground and turn into fossil fuel isn't as readily available as it once was. So that's the solution to tonight's puzzle.
If you put a comment.
Please, comment away.
I remember learning about this in science class a couple of years back. Lignin decay is not responsible for the advancement of the Carboniferous era of coal, generation. In fact, I'm pretty sure if you look at locations across the U.S., fungi capable of consuming lignin had very little to no effect on the various places that have an abundance of coal. And it's something that you probably want to do more reading on, because I remember talking about this and reading about this, and this definitely is not the case. KB to after me.
Okay, like I said, this is not written in stone. This is just a premise that a lot of people do believe in. And after the science talk, I will post a link from National Geographic. It's an article written about 2-3 years ago about this entire story. It is not 100% of all the coal. It's about 90% of the coal. They're all coal deposits that are younger. It's just that the overwhelming majority are older. But nothing is written in stone. I'm just suggesting the theory that seems to be the most popular. I'm sure you can find people who have other theories that they prefer over that. So I don't think anything definitively has been proved in the 2-3 years passed since that article, or the National Geographic kind of didn't do their research either, but I'll look further into it.
Very good, sir. And I did pull that article up. When we say 90%, we talk about the Carboniferous period, but that has no relationship with it. That's definitely something to continue to read on and reread the articles we've already read. Very good, sir. Back to the test. Can you talk to me?
Into the machine.
Yes, Wesley.
You forgot to say that post formation starts with accumulation of volcanic matter. It could be vital that land in low oxygen setting such bad bulk. So if this element doesn't exist, there's no coal. Interesting.
Okay, Wes, I'm not quite sure where you're going with this one. Basically, this turnover of organic material throughout the lifespan of life itself on the Earth. sometimes the devices that life finds to return nutrients back into the system happen quickly evolve, and sometimes they take a little bit more time to fully evolve. And so it's not quite the concept of the material was kind of always there since life began. It's that a lot of it could not be, from this theory, a lot of it couldn't be processed and returned back to the cycle of life to be turned into something else quickly and had enough time to be locked up in the bosom of the earth and allowed it to kind of decompose into its base carbon atoms.
I was on the thing that you pointed one side of the story, and you made a stress on bacteria and fungus, but the organic matter accumulates and forms a bed pit. The pit bed gets buried by other sediments under the heat, and the pressure begins to transport to low-grade coal. Lignite, I don't know how to say it properly in English. So more heat and pressure further metamorphose the lignite into bituminous coal. Let me drop it. Even more heat and the pressure metamorphose the bituminous coal into nice, hard, shiny anthracite coal. So when you say something, you're pointing at one side of the story. I say that low oxygen is needed for the coal to form. And I said that there are the conditions for the coal to form. And to actually...
Okay, Wes, I mean, I really didn't go into detail of the chemical cause of the initial material turning into coal. I was more looking at the original material being in much higher abundance during a period of geological periods where there was just a lot of dead trees that you could work with. Now there just are less because it's you have to be luckier to find things like peat deposits and such. And there's still creation of coal. It's just dramatically smaller than during the Carboniferous era. That's all I was kind of alluding to. It's more complicated. Almost everything is more complicated than any puzzle that I can throw at people, because life is complicated. So, yeah, there's a whole mechanism in which organic material decomposes into coal of different types, and you're quite right. But that wasn't the point of this little puzzler. It was the interesting to me concept that life throws all kinds of wild punches at the world and causes disequilibrium that takes some time for the system to equalize. So, you know, we talk of nature as a kind of a constant, never-changing that we're screwing around with, but nature changes itself. And I just thought it would be an interesting way of looking upon how nature itself can introduce revolutionary changes that wreak havoc on what once was, and some would say make the world a better place. If it wasn't for plant life, human beings wouldn't be possible. We require the efficiency of oxidative phosphorylation to fuel ourselves. We couldn't get by on just kind of sniffing methane gas.
Yeah, I mean, if that would be only the organic element that transforms, but in some coal deposits, such as Cretaceous and territory of the western interior of the U.S., where I was actually there, there is a trap sediment from volcanic asphalt. The coal can contain not just concentrated plant debris, but also sediments brought in by water airborne ash falls and absorbed by the carbon from the coal from the groundwater and minerals from its fractures and space. So it's not really organic material. That's my addition to that. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, you're welcome as always, Wesley. Anyone else have any comments, questions, or what have you about what we were talking about earlier? Very well. I don't quite know if this fits in a science talk, but since I'm the guy doing it, I might as well. I've always been a fan of rather concisely stated principles that are sometimes our irrational world can be seen to follow at least part of the time. You know, things like Occam's razor that states that the simplest solution is most likely the right one, or one of my favorites is the Dunning-Kruger effect that states that those who are incompetent in a subject have little insight into their own competence in that subject. Now, recently, I've become aware of a rather new one that I hadn't heard before, although I kind of understood the principle behind it and kind of agreed with it before I saw that it had a name. So I thought some of you might find this interesting. This one's called Hansen's Razor, and it states, never attribute to malice that which can be adequately explained by stupidity. Which is not to say there's no malice in this world of ours. It's just that there might be a lot more stupidity than any malice. So I give it to you for what it's worth. It's called Hansen's Razor, and it's going to... I'm going to put it up on a wall someplace. It's a great phrase, at least, to explain some of the things that are going on in this world. Anyone have any questions or comments before I go into the usual newsy type of segment?
If you like Hanlon's razor, I think you'll appreciate looking up Hitchin's razor. See what that one is about. Katie Chesterby.
Is that Hitchin's the atheist who died a couple years ago?
That does sound correct. I do remember they were in news, and I believe they did talk to her a couple of bugs. But I suspect that the razor itself, which actually I believe has roots in some other Latin phrase, might be of interest.
Okay, I'll look it up. I think all of these things lend themselves to the ancient Occam's razor. That I think if anyone asked if there's a any kind of a logical statement that includes the name razor to it, they'll come up with Occam's razor. But Hitchin's was an interesting guy. He was a brilliant man. I used to enjoy listening to him talk. It's sort of a shame that he tended to smoke a lot of cigars, drink a lot of alcohol, and a lot of times that bad combination ends up with a head and neck cancer, which is what he unfortunately died of prematurely. But he was a clever man who could insult people without them even knowing that they were being insulted. He was just that type of a guy. Thanks for the pointer. I shall look Hitchin's razor up. I love these little aphorisms, these epistemological razors that people come up with. Okay, let's go on with the stories then. A new telescopic survey of Hygieia, the fourth largest object in the main asteroid belt, suggests it's a dwarf planet due to its surprisingly spherical shape. Discovered in 1849 by Italian astronomer Annibale de Gasparis, Hygieia is located in the main asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. It's the fourth largest object in that belt, with Ceres, Vesta, and Pallas being the only bigger ones. The Of the three, only Ceres is considered a dwarf planet, by the way. Despite its size, however, Hygieia has remained a poorly studied object, and it's easily the most mysterious of the Big Four. New research published recently in Nature Astronomy revises much of what we know about Hygieia, including its shape, its size, its rotation, and its origin story. The study was made possible thanks to a recent observation made by the European Space Agency's Sphere instrument on the very large telescope in Chile's Atacama Desert. Most significantly, the new research suggests Hygieia's status should be upgraded from an asteroid to a dwarf planet. Should this happen, Hygieia would supplant Ceres as the smallest dwarf planet in our solar system. Let me drop for a sec. According to criteria devised by the International Astronomical Union, in 2006, a celestial object needs to satisfy four requirements to earn its designation as a dwarf planet. It needs to be in its own orbit around the sun. It can't be a moon. It has to vacuum up other material in its immediate vicinity, and it has to achieve what's called hydrostatic equilibrium. In other words, it's mostly spherical in shape, having sufficient gravity to overcome a rigid, irregular form. The new research suggests Hygieia has met all four of these requirements, including the hydrostatic equilibrium. By comparing Hygieia's sphericity with that of other solar system's objects, it appears that Hygieia is nearly as spherical as Ceres, opening a possibility for this object to be reclassified as a dwarf planet, declared the authors in this new study. An improved estimate of Hygieia's diameter places its width at about 267 miles. By comparison, Pluto and Ceres, the two other dwarf planets, featured diameters of 1,490 miles and 590 miles, respectively. A revised estimate of the object's rotational period shows a single day on Hygieia lasts for about 13.8 hours, which is roughly half of the previous estimate. Two relatively small craters were spotted on its surface, one about 112 miles wide and the other about 60 miles wide. Going into the project, the astronomers were expecting to find a massive crater associated with the object's origin. Hygieia is the largest member of the Hygieia family of asteroids, a collection of nearly 7,000 objects tied to the same parent body. Accordingly, the scientists were expecting to see a large impact basin on Hygieia, similar to the one found on Vesta that's approximately 310 miles in diameter. Let me drop for a sec. Neither of these two craters could have been caused by the impact that originated the Hygieia family of asteroids, whose volume is comparable to that of a 60-mile-sized object. They're just too small, the co-author of the new paper suggested. Using computer simulations, the researchers showed that the Hygieia family of asteroids could have been spawned by a massive head-on collision with an object measuring somewhere between 46 to 93 miles in size. The resulting collision obliterated Hygieia's parent body, which is noted measured around 62 miles across, but over the eons, much of the ensuing debris reassembled to form the mostly sphere-shaped object that we see today. This collision is estimated to have happened over 2 billion years ago, according to the new research. Looking ahead, they will now have to decide if Hygieia should be granted dwarf planet status. Perhaps more importantly, Hygieia, with its relatively fresh surface, is distinguished from other main belt objects, including Vesta and Ceres, making it a compelling object for further study and possibly even a robotic mission. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
KD2NBB with a question.
Yes, Bob.
Roy, this is the first I've heard of a dwarf planet. What differentiates a dwarf planet from a normal planet? Is it diameter or weight? And if so, what's the number for that? Back to you.
It really depends upon the size, whether it's a full-size one or a small one. I unfortunately don't have available right now in my head what's the criteria, but there's a bunch of different things, but size is one of the big things, which is, you know, why we call it a dwarf planet as opposed to a full-size planet.
Okay, very good. I guess, yeah, I could probably look this up on Google and probably find that kind of information pretty quickly. Thanks, Roy.
Hey, very good, Bob. Anyone else with any comments or questions before I move on to the next?
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
A lot of these planets, well, the dwarf planets are out in the Kuiper Belt. You know, they said there's like 128 recently. I just read that. 128 now. So, you know, they're not as big as Pluto, but some of them are getting pretty close to that size. But that's the main difference. And like Pluto is now a dwarf planet because they said that, you know, that's not, you know, it never cleared out the Kuiper Belt, you know, everything surrounding it, which is, you know, kind of silly reason to do it, but that's one of the criteria. So, you know, they just change the names around. They're calling them dwarf planets, and Sirius is one, and now you said this new one is going to be one. But I think that's really the difference, you know, as long as they wind up spherical and clearing the planet, their area, like the Earth and Venus, there's nothing really near us, that makes it a planet, you know. There's a lot of exceptions and arguments about this, too. I mean, in reality, Jupiter never cleared out the Trojan asteroids. So, you know, it's a lot of opinions, different opinions by these different societies. Back to you, Ryan.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially people who aren't in these societies really got upset. They kind of were used to Pluto. I think it's a matter of, it's kind of ultimately the same sort of thing. It doesn't have enough of a gravity well to clear its orbit, and the rationale that they use for Jupiter not clearing its orbit is because those asteroids are in somewhat protected regions of space around Jupiter that kind of go into equilibrium that maintain it in those points. So that's the reason, I guess, they have for those areas in Jupiter and such. But, you know, some people still long for the days that Pluto was a planet. I can understand that. I don't like when they change classifications that much, or especially when they change the names of major cities into different things. Sometimes things that rhyme with the original one, you know, like Peking versus Beijing. Okay, on with the next. The New York authorities have given a 316-megawatt battery storage project the green light. The project will pack enough power to provide over 250,000 households with electricity for up to 8 hours. The project aims to stabilize local power grid and curtail the use of oil and natural gas. Renewables now reported that it will provide peak capacity, energy, and ancillary services, and will also offset carbon-intensive on-peak generation that will improve the grid reliability in New York City. A statement was issued from the New York Public Service Commission, which approved the proposal to build the new 316-megawatt facility. A report said that the plant represents what will turn out to be New York State's biggest battery system. The site is at the Ravenswood Generating Station along the East River in Long Island City, Queens. The system planned at the Ravenswood Power Plant in Long Island City will be built in three phases, with the first coming online in 2021, said Chris Martin in Bloomberg. The three phases will involve 129 megawatts, 98 megawatts, and finally 89 megawatts, said Clean Technica. PV Magazine USA said plans were to build out in three phases, with the first phase completed by 2021. Steve Hanley and Clean Technica made a note that the enormous battery will raise the noise level at the site by only 3 decibels, an important consideration because there is a residential community nearby. Namely, the project calls for batteries replacing old combustion turbines at the Ravenswood plant. The proposed storage project will consist of 136 battery storage and inverter units, 64 of which will be double stacked on the property. Let me drop for a sec. The battery project would demolish and replace 16 combustion turbines that are about 50 years old. Said Green Tech Media, only 2 remain in service, but they only fire them up occasionally. Steve Hanley and Clean Technica also reported that a site on Vernon Avenue in Queens, New York, once was home to a 16 gas-powered peaker plant. Only 2 remain in operation today. In December 2017, the writing was on the wall that power plants in Astoria and Long Island were troubling environmental watchers. More than 50% of the city's power comes from power plants located in Astoria and Long Island City. For decades, power plants had been notorious for emitting dangerous pollutants that risk our environment and public health, a local councilman said in a report. This pollution has contributed to increased respiratory illness, higher asthma rates, emergency room visits, and other public health issues. Ending use of dirty fuel oils will reduce these emissions and bring benefits to our public health. As for the new development, Hanley and Clean Technica raised the emission issue and explained how the picture changes. Ravenswood Development acknowledges that the electricity stored in the Queens battery could come from any source, including coal or natural gas, but that the facility will lower the carbon emissions in the area because it will make possible for local utilities to curtail the use of power of peaker plants, which tend to emit high levels of carbon dioxide when they're brought online. And, of course, the more renewable energy is available to the local grid, the lower these emissions will be. Let me drop for a sec. Daily Energy Insider quoted the commission chair, John Rhodes, who said, when complete, this facility will displace energy produced from fossil plants during peak periods, resulting in cleaner air and reduced carbon emissions. If this project is deployed fully, said PV Magazine USA, the 316 megawatts of power would meet just over 10% of New York State's goal of 3,000 megawatts by 2030. Bloomberg presented a big-picture view of the economic interest. The push for massive energy storage projects in general comes as battery prices plummet and officials harness the technology to smooth power flow on grids and displace gas plants that only run when demand peaks and incorporate more wind and solar energy. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
BDH with a question.
Yes, VDH.
Is this going to be the only or the first of its kind storage element on the grid? I remember hearing somewhere that the phrase the grid does not store energy. I remember also in the late 60s, I remember they were going to do a pump storage plant at Storm King Mountain. I don't know whatever became of that. But is this the first of its kind storage element on the grid in general? Go ahead.
Would be my understanding. According to what I've read, the plans for New York State are for a total of 3,000 megawatts of battery storage. So this first effort will be the first 10%. They expect to have the rest online by 2030, according to what I've read.
I see. Okay, thanks.
Okay, any other questions or comments, or I'll move on to the next subject.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Remember that Storm King Mountain? I think that was pretty much built, but whether it ever got, you know, the blue ribbon treatment or not, I don't know. But they spent years. I know one guy that worked, actually two people that worked there, and they spent years pouring concrete, you know. Never, you know, it was continuous pour, you know, for the dams and the, what they were going to do there. And I don't think it ever opened, though. But, yeah, they were going to pump all the water up there, and then when they needed more power, the water would be able to flow back down through the turbines.
Ah, that sounds like a great idea. I wonder what exactly got stuck someplace. But unfortunately, especially when it comes to energy utilities, there's a lot of things that start to get built and they never turn the damn things on. And that's one of the many reasons why energy costs are higher than they probably should be. Any other questions or comments, or I'll move on to the next story.
They say what kind of batteries they're going to be using. Is this going to be a whole block full of lithium-ion batteries?
Unfortunately, I couldn't get any decent information on what kind of technology they're planning to use. I mean, I in the back of my head, I figured that this is going to turn into yet another Elon Musk story, where Tesla is supplying the batteries, but they don't really go into specifics.
I can see that. About it is from you, so I'll look into it as well.
It should be interesting. I would tend to guess that it's going to be one of the latest, greatest battery technologies. I would be sort of surprised to find out if they're all just a bunch of lead-acid cells stacked on top of each other. Because there's part of in the story about the drop in production costs for the battery technology. So I'm assuming that it's going to end up being some variation on lithium. Be it lithium iron or lithium iron phosphate, probably more of a lithium ion situation. But it'll be interesting to see, and I hope it works. It sounds like a good idea rather than these emergency generators that they seem to use to hit the peak times with.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I remember going to a lot of these buildings that had backup battery systems for everything, for all the electronics and computers years ago, and they had battery rooms, and they were filled with X-Lite batteries, you know, lead-acid batteries, and hundreds of them, and they were all, you know, in series and parallel, whatever it took to supply the building. I just can't see them using that older technology. Hopefully they go with lithium ion or something. Maybe even something that's newer coming down the road. But you know, if they go with that, they're going to have all kinds of problems. They're not going to last. They'll be replacing them. Could you imagine replacing millions of batteries all the time? You know, every time they fail, which ones are failing? The electronics behind it, monitoring every single one. This sounds like a big deal.
I think if it was going to be lead acid, they wouldn't wait until now to do it, because lead acid really hasn't changed in price in the last 30 years or so. Neither has the technology much. So I hope for the sake of this project, they have something much newer and shinier than lead acid cells. I don't know if you follow. There's a guy who writes every so often an article in QST. He apparently decided, I think he lives in Florida, and he decided that he had one blackout too many, and he basically filled his entire garage with lead acid cell batteries and a generator, and he keeps it charged up. And he was talking about how he has to kind of rotate the batteries out because they have a relatively limited lifespan. And I was thinking of, you know, this guy could probably, for the cost of this system of his, put himself up in a really nice hotel for a week anytime the power goes out. But I guess he was more interested in the solution than the problem.
Yeah. That's I didn't read about him, but I could see him doing it though.
When I read the article, I sort of felt sorry for the guy's poor wife who probably wanted to put a car in the garage instead of a bunch of batteries.
Okay, copy that. I guess a bunch of 12-volt batteries. The ones I was talking about that they used for these buildings as backups, everyone was I believe it was 2.1 volts, you know. And it was a big battery. I mean, each one was almost the size of a car battery, and they were all lined up. Next slide.
Well, you just serially connect them as long as you have load balancing and such, and you can bring the voltage up to whatever you want. They'll put it through inverters and produce relatively clean 60-cycle AC alternating current voltage. I've seen those kind of emergency setups in small versions. I don't think I've gone to any company that kind of electrified and storage batteried their entire facility. But it's doable if you throw enough money at it.
Comment on one whitey white.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, it is doable. But sometimes, like you say, people tend to focus on the solution rather than the problem. And I recall a gentleman that used to own a boat in the same dock or marina that I had mine on. And when he moved to land, he took all his stuff from the boat that he could used to generate power, and he stuck it in his house, and he ended up with a marine diesel generator for which he had to supply water and then dispose of water that was used for coolant, and he ended up with a, I believe the word was Trace brand 24-volt inverter, sine wave, pure sine wave inverter battery charging system, and it was a tremendous amount of work for him to maintain these batteries, and he had these things called hydrolyzer caps, which caught the gas as it was expelled from the battery during the charging cycle and allowed the water to be reclaimed and drip back down into the cells. It was a very, very elaborate problem or solution to a problem that really didn't exist in the Miami area, and one YDY.
Sorry, Hank. I call those guys having solutions in search of a problem. They come up with something. They either have a piece of equipment like the person that you know, or they come up with some clever idea that isn't necessary, but they have to see it through. So that's what they do. I mean, sometimes it's rather fascinating to watch it. It's just about as fascinating as to watch these hoarders that they have on some cable shows. What someone cleverness can come up with, even though it doesn't make any particular sense of why they should spend their time doing that. So, yeah, I tend to think of those as solutions in search of problems.
Well, I think this guy, you know, he was so used to spending time on the boat, all the things that a boat requires, that when he got rid of the boat, this became where he spent his free time. And I did watch him build it. He would invite us over and, you know, let us drink beer and eat off his barbecue while he was explaining how wonderful this system was. But it was kind of weird. And with that, I'll say thank you very much for listening, and one white and white.
Welcome, Hank, anytime. Anyone with any other questions or comments before I move on to the next story? Okay, if the latest statistics are any indication, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is no longer just an issue for children alone. Over a 10-year period, ADHD rates more than doubled among American adults, new research shows. However, the rate among children remains much higher than in adults. Quote, while we can't pinpoint the source of the increase in ADHD rates in adults, we can surmise that it has to do with growing recognition of ADHD in the adult population by both doctors and service providers, as well as increased public awareness of ADHD overall, said the study co-author Dr. Michael Millam. He is vice president of research at the Child Mind Institute in New York City. For the study, researchers analyzed data from more than 5 million Kaiser Permanente Northern California patients and found that the percentage of adults with a diagnosis of ADHD rose from 0.3% in 2007 up to 0.96% in 2016. White adults showed a larger increase from 0.67 to 1.42 than those in other race or ethnic groups. Adults with other mental health conditions such as depression and bipolar anxiety or eating disorder were more likely to have ADHD. The researchers also found that adults with ADHD had higher rates of healthcare use and of sexually transmitted infections. Meanwhile, ADHD diagnosis among children aged 5 to 11 rose from 2.96% in 2007 up to 3.74% in 2016. That's a 26% increase. The study was published online November 1st in JAMA's Network Open. Let me drop for a sec. Quote, more work needs to be done to better understand why rates are higher in white adults, particularly whether there are deficiencies in detection and diagnoses among non-white adults, end quote, Milam said in a journal news release. And he added, we must develop more effective diagnostic tools and standards for adults who in general remain more challenging to diagnose than children. Study lead author Winston Chung, a psychiatrist with Kaiser Permanente in San Francisco, noted that people in some cultures are less likely to regard certain behaviors as a disorder or to seek help for them. It's always been just understood that different cultures and races might vary in meaningful ways in how they cope with stress or expressing emotions, Chung said. However, this is something we don't actually have definitive answers to, and more research is needed, he added. What might be causing the increase in cases is a mystery to medical science at this point, but it will search out for possible causes. Until then, YouTubers are free to promote their own theories that no doubt involve negative chi, Planet X, and weapons from the intelligent life hiding in the center of the Earth. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
VDH with a comment.
VDH.
I'm just wondering if there's any correlation with cell phone use or stuff like that. Because, and quite honestly, I've seen some extreme attention deficit where people are concentrating more on their phones than the immediate surroundings around them.
I agree with you. That the type of distraction is endemic in our society. It tends to afflict older people than children, since we haven't gotten to the point where we've totally saturated youngsters with cell phones. But that's probably going to cause problems as well. So the problem in general is our society has decreased its attention span. Its media has kind of fed, it's kind of a feedback loop. The people kind of like fast-paced stuff, so they see a lot of fast-paced games and fast-paced videos and such, which kind of feeds that speed. If anyone, watches a movie from the 70s or the 80s, a lot of times they get this sense that it's dragging and going too slow. That's just because of the pace of our information input has seemed to go up. And I can't help but think that some of this might be the sensory overload that we seem to be provoking in ourselves. But, that's up to the psychiatrist and psychologist to do their research of what's causing it. But I don't know about cell phones. It certainly isn't helping the problem.
WHUCDL. Good evening. With some intimation that I checked out.
Sandy.
That's tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
One thing that happens to me, and I just want to share it, and I'm wondering if anybody else experiences this situation. When I am on my computer, or if I'm looking at a computer screen. In other words, some TFT display, large TFT display, or a display of some type, not a cathode ray tube display, but CRT. I tend to get more tired more easily. Not distracted, but and it's hard to explain it. The what I go through, but it seems that somehow, and I think I read this somewhere, where the refresh rate of these displays, and maybe even our cell phones that we're holding in our hands, because everybody's staring at a screen, is affecting our eyesight. Something to do with the scan rate, or the frequency of the scan rate, you know, as opposed to, I remember when I was a kid, my mother always used to say to me, don't stay too close to the TV because it'll hurt your eyes. Now, I don't know how true that, and this was back in the 50s, I don't know how true that expression was back then, but I know that it happens to me. I can't stare in front of a computer screen for too long because I do get tired. And it's not like sleepy tired, it's a different type of tiredness. Can you relate to what I'm saying in such a way? Lori, back to you, WA2CDL.
Then KD2OGV. Craig.
Craig, you wanted to say something.
Andy, are you looking at the computer screen with lights or...
Let's go to net control on that, so I don't have to answer direct, because I don't think the net is set up that way. Roy, back to you, and then you could direct it, and then I can answer that question.
Yeah, very good, Andy. You will get back to you, Craig. As far as vision, a couple of things. My mother also said don't sit too close to the TV. There's no indication that sitting close to the TV caused any problem. There was a kind of weird scare that there were X-ray emissions in cathode ray tubes. I don't know if mothers picked up on that or they just didn't want their children to sit too close to the TV set. You know, I don't know of anyone who had any kind of a visual problems from staring at a television set back in the 50s and the 60s. So that's one thing. As far as liquid crystal displays, for the most part, because very few people can afford a computer screen that's an organic light-emitting diode technology, liquid crystal displays tend to have some problems. They have different refresh rates, though, so not all refresh rates are equal. There are some monitors, low-end monitors, that have the simple 60 cycle refresh rate. There are 120, there are 240s. So there's different multiples in the refresh rate. Some people suggest it's the blue content of the LCD monitors that are causing the problem, and optometrists will sell you something called the blue blocker coating on your reading glasses to block some of the bluest coloration of the screen. And as I think Craig was alluding to, it's never a good idea to have a bright screen in a dark room. It's always good to have a room that's reasonably well lit if you have a bright screen going on. I think that's what he was alluding to. But did I at least touch upon your points, Andy?
Yes, and especially, you know, mentioning the blue emissions, you know, maybe even some of the emissions that we can't detect with our eye, and the refresh rate. Yes, I mean that would be a possible cause. Yeah, I was told this, and I forget. And this goes back a ways. It was also mentioned to wear those special glasses that'll block the blue color that's being emitted from the CRT. Oh, I shouldn't say CRT, TFT or LCD, whatever display it is. And that would, you wouldn't get fatigued as easily. Now, I don't know what this has to do with ADD, attention deficit, directly, but it may have an indirect effect. That's why I brought it up. Because if you're getting tired and fatigued, you're not gonna hold attention. You know, you would want to relax and put it away for a while. So that may have like an indirect effect. That's why I brought it up in the first place. So you did hit upon that, Roy. Thanks. WA2CDL, back to you.
7-2-Rio. Hey, Richie, you're third after Craig. We'll get to you. So, blue blockers, there's also software available. I know there's software for the PC. I think it's part of the Apple operating system that you can actually set it that either you could set it.